Welcome to a special meeting of the Utah State Tax Commission. I'm Chairman John Valentine. I'll be presiding at the meeting today. Also present at the meeting are, to my far right, Commissioner Cragen, to my left, Commissioner Pirro, and to my far left, and that's nothing political, Commissioner Rockwell. Also present are Barry Conover, the Executive Director of the Tax Commission, and Krista Johnson, the Administrative Assistant of the Tax Commission. This meeting is being recorded as required by the Utah Public Open Meetings Act. The meeting is being held at the Davis County Conference Center, 1651 North, 700 West, Layton, Utah. The recording will be kept at the offices of the Commission as required by the Open Meetings Act. That location is 210 North, 1950 West in Salt Lake City. This matter that would be considered today is only one item on the agenda, and that is an open meeting where members of the audience may ask questions, make presentations, or otherwise make requests of the Commission. The only requirement we have under the Act and under the rules that govern us is that we cannot discuss cases that are pending or that are reasonably imminent. That's the statutory framework from which we have to work. So with that, I can open up to our commissioners to each have them give a brief just welcome and hello, and then we'll go to the audience. We'll start with our senior most commissioner, Commissioner Cragen.
I still laugh every time I hear that. I can't figure out how, after 6 years, I'm the senior guy, but I guess it just means here I've been here the longest. First thing I want to say is, please just relax. This is just the same conversation we always have. Krista's just here to make a recording in case Dan Harry decides he wants to write an editorial about how great we all are. So be able to prove it. So. I'm grateful to be here with you again. I know that you all want to discuss a particular case, but it's still under our jurisdiction until about 5 o'clock tomorrow, so we can't talk about it now, but I promise we'll talk about it as soon as we can. But thank you for letting me be with you and to work with you, and please always feel free to call whenever you have questions or comments or anything I can do to help. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Pirro.
You know, while I was at Carbon County all those years, I seen a lot of you at UAC and other functions. And when I came up here, I thought, wow, I'm going to lose all of that. But we really haven't, and actually it's got better. And I appreciate working with you guys and seeing you. I've just grown to love you, and I just love to work with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Finally, Commissioner Rockwell.
Thank you. I think I had ample opportunity to introduce myself yesterday, so I won't introduce myself further, but I am happy to see so many familiar faces in the room, and I'm grateful to have had the opportunities I have over the course of the years to work with you. I have great respect for what you do and look forward to a continuing relationship in the future.
Thank you very much. That completes the opening of the commission. The time is now yours to ask the questions or to make presentations that you would like us to consider.
Oh, come on, Kathleen, haven't you got something?
Or Cindy?
We're not opposed to short meetings. Nothing to say. We'll go back to the office.
Maybe I have a question with the commission, and as we as we schedule up hearings, could you kind of share with the committee? I know that Salt Lake County does an awful lot of mediation. Maybe one of the commissioners would like to talk about mediation and how that's working, and will it continue to work, or whatever the case might be with the counties?
Okay, let me just start off with that then quickly. There's three ways that we deal after you file, after a taxpayer files an initial appeal. The first one is the initial hearing, which is a formal hearing under the Administrative Procedures Act. And that hearing is done with proffers, as many of you know, is not a evidentiary hearing where we take sworn testimony. That's one option. The second option is if both parties desire to waive that initial hearing, you can waive the initial hearing and go directly to the formal and final hearing. The third option is the mediation option, which was started prior to my coming there, but we've really tried to really push forward on the idea of mediation. Last year, we had about 2,800 cases that were filed with the Tax Commission for appeals. Many of them were local, some centrally assessed. Some of those cases also involved income tax and sales tax and other forms of problems, licensing on the motor vehicle side or on some of our retailers. And so all those types of cases come before the commission. Out of those 2,800 cases, we only had about 200 that ended up going to formals. The rest were all resolved, either by stipulation or by agreement or by parties withdrawing one side or the other. Out of the 200 cases, those 200 cases have an option of going a different, two different ways after they leave us. The first way is to go to a trial de novo, where the taxpayer in the county or the division has to start all over again. And they have a trial in the district court and a tax court judge who is assigned to that particular type of cases. From there, they can go on appeal to the appellate courts. Or they can go straight on appeal from the records that we create in the formal hearing to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court can then port over to the Court of Appeals, which we've seen in some of the cases. For example, the ATK Thiokol case, it did that. It went up, came back, went up, went back on a pour over, and then finally came back with a final decision. So you have two ways you can go once you've left the commission. Last year, how many can tell me how many of those 200 cases that we had formals that went to either a trial de novo or a Supreme Court appeal? That's the right answer. Zero. Zero went from us. We're thinking that one of the reasons why that's happening is that people are actually satisfied with the actions that are being occurring in the commission. And we have cases on appeal, and we'll always have cases on appeal that go to the courts. We'll have that because people aren't satisfied with the results that they get. But I think that we're really making attempts to try to do problem resolution rather than just trying to exact the highest possible tax we can from a taxpayer. Any other commissioners like to comment?
Yeah, I have a couple of comments. First of all, thank you for those of you who are willing to do mediations this year. One of the trends that I've experienced in the 6 years that I've been here is that because of the volume of appeals that we had when I got here, it was taking a long time to get hearing dates set, and then it was taking a long time to write the orders and get them out, and it wasn't up to our standards, but we were working as best we could with the resources that we had. By doing the mediations this year and by having the commissioners participate in a lot of the mediations, that took a lot of pressure off of our administrative law judges, and they've been able to focus on getting caught up. We're now doing hearings within a 3 or 4 month window of when the appeal comes to us rather than a 6 to 8 month window like we were before. This coming year, we expect that we'll see that the administrative law judges will now have the capacity to do more of the mediations that are closer here to the offices on the Wasatch Front. The commissioners will still go out and visit the counties that are away from the Wasatch Front, just so that we get away from Salt Lake and we see the territory of the state that we're not around all the time, and also to save you and your property owners, your taxpayers, the necessity of coming to Salt Lake for the initial hearing or the mediation if you want to continue doing it. So thank you. It has helped us get caught up, and I think you'll see that things are getting out faster, and it's certainly taken a lot of pressure off of our administrative law judges.
Thank you. Others? One other comment that I'd like to quickly make is one of the things that I've set as a goal for the commission as coming in as the new chairman a year and some months ago was to try to be more expeditious in the way we handle the cases. In other words, be more timely. I'd heard rumors when I was in the legislature about cases that had languished for 6 years before the commission finally issued the orders on them. So that was one of the first things I investigated, is how long we had some of those orders pending. And we did have some orders that were pending for a long time, cases that had been fully adjudicated, fully briefed, and yet no opinions have been rendered. We're in the process of trying to rectify that, as Commissioner Cragen has observed. We're trying to make certain that those time frames are much more timely, that we get the hearings scheduled, we get the trials done, and that we get the opinions written, deliberated, and issued. Those are something we think is important, because you have to know with finality what's happening, and the taxpayer has to know with finality what's happening. The backlog was not 6 years when I got there. The longest standing case that I could find was 3 years out. We got that one out. It's done. Our backlog now is about 18 months, so we've cut it about in half, and we'll continue to work on it over the next couple of years to try to be very more timely with the appeal decisions as they come through the process. Anything further on this particular issue? Again, thank you for helping us by participating in the mediation process. We think it's helped the whole caseload, and it's helped the whole process that we've dealt with as we've tried to deal with the cases that we have had them before us. Yes. Okay, now we've got one. Good, Kathy. Make sure you come up to the microphone, Kathy. I'm sorry, because
you can sacrifice a deacon to bring you the mic if you want.
The other day, some of you I know sat in the breakout session that we had on equity appeals. And I just wanted to get some of your thoughts on that. Many years ago, none of you were here, we had a case in Cache County that was an equity appeal. It was a gentleman who built a cabin up in an area of what we call Legacy Ranches, up in Blacksmith Fort Canyon. The cabin was a kit. He was building it himself. So each year we had to go back, because it took several years to build, we went back each year to determine how much of that property was complete. We had a standby value. So each year we went back and checked that value. His appeal, when he filed it, was an equity appeal. He could not argue market value, because the value we had on it was much less than what he had paid for the kit. So he argued equity. His argument in the equity appeal was that we had been back and changed his value every year. Indeed, we had, because of the percent complete that happened every year. But we had not been up and revalued the other cabins in the area every year as we had his. In our opinion, it wasn't an equity issue. The other cabins weren't like his. One was a manufactured home that had some construction built over it. His was a beautiful kit with log kit. It was a much different. So in our mind, it wasn't an equity appeal, but that's what he argued. To our surprise, he won. It was an initial hearing. He won the case because we had changed his value every year, but we had not changed the adjacent properties every year. I could have gone to a formal hearing and argued further. The ALJ who wrote the decision is still there. Nothing against him. I believe that equity was new enough that we didn't really know, any of us, what was expected. So I did as was suggested. Every year thereafter, I revalued all of the cabins in that area. Did not make the cabin owners very happy. I can play the game just as they can play the game, and that's what ended up happening. I'm just wondering your thoughts on equity appeals and what you believe is enough evidence, if you will, to determine equity. And I realize every case is different, but maybe some guidelines that we know to follow. Oftentimes I find in the local hearings
that at first they come in arguing market value. When they get the feeling that's not going so well for them, now we're going to argue equity. And so it's like we're just chasing the cat around the room. It just keeps going and going and going. Before you answer that, I just want to say thank you to Commissioner Valentine. I believe in all of my years here, yesterday was the first time I've ever heard any commissioner say, come to us if you have questions. We're willing to help and answer those. I appreciate that because we respect your opinion. We rely on your thoughts and your feelings, and so I appreciate that. It's up to you.
Thank you. And would like to take a first stab at it. Commissioner Craig.
Sure. I have some questions about your other case, but we maybe can talk about that later. Okay. But I guess my question, I'll just say it. The way you did it, did you start with like a market value, say the market value of this cabin is $100,000 and the first year it was 20% complete and the next year it was 30% complete, so the $100,000 never changed? It was just the percent complete that changed every year?
100% complete, correct.
So you didn't recalculate the market value every year?
We did not.
Okay.
But we did change percent complete.
If that happens again with this commission, go to a formal.
we thought it was a slam dunk, truly.
Yeah. Right.
That's why he couldn't argue market value. But what he did see, as many taxpayers do, they come in, they scour through our tax roll, and he could see that his value changed every year, but nobody else's did. So he felt we were singling him out.
Yeah.
There was not equity.
I'd want to look. I'm curious. I want to get the appeal number for her because I want to pull it and see if the commission understood that you were using the same market value every year but just changing the percent complete. Because if those were the facts and those were the facts the commission understood, I can't understand why they wouldn't have agreed with you. But if they understood the facts to be that you were only reappraising or reassessing the other properties every 5 years, but this one was getting appraised every year, I could see how that's a winning argument if those are the facts that were understood. But to your bigger question, I've only seen two or three equalization appeals win. Most of the time people come in, like you say, and they're just trying to throw everything at us that they can, but they don't really bring us a set of comparable properties, and that's where they always lose. Is yeah, they got a lot of properties in their neighborhood that are assessed lower than theirs are, but they can't show us how these properties are comparable to theirs. And in fact, the assessors usually come in and show us why they're not comparable. And I can't remember which session we were in this week where somebody was talking about. I think it was the equity session, and it was Randy Kelly who got up and talked about, I'm the home teacher in these homes, and so I know what they're like. We actually had somebody make that argument. I home teach the lady in this house, and so I know that her house is comparable to mine. But the assessor came in and was able to say, look, here are all these other properties. Frequently, you'll see in our orders that we say that one is not enough, because the Supreme Court in Mountain Ranch Estates has said that it has to be a systematic. Everybody keeps asking, well, what if you got five that show that there's an error and 10 that show that there's not an error? And I heard lots of asking, where's the dividing line? I don't know where it is. I can see where there could be a winning argument that if you've got five really comparable properties that are lower than the assessed, than the subject property, that could be a winner, even if there are 10 other identical properties that are assessed higher, because there could be an argument that there was some sort of an error And this guy noticed it and came in and asked for relief. Sorry to the 10 other suckers who didn't notice it and come in and ask for relief. I could see that being a winning argument. So be careful about the, we've got more than you've got, because the standard is there a systematic error and does it need to be corrected in order to perform, to preserve the constitutional equity? Thank you.
Commissioner Pirro.
I've had several appeals this year that involve equity, and one of them in particular, I had a ton of data, and had the taxpayer provided more information, enough that I could have actually analyzed it and broke it down to see if they were really comparable, it could have went different. But we have to look at all the information that is presented. We don't go out on a expedition and try to find more information. Take what's given to us and make a ruling from there. But it's how much information is submitted that, for me, really makes the difference.
We've seen a growing trend of taxpayers trying to present cases on equalization arguments where they show that the percentage of increase is on theirs is different than the percentage of increase on their neighbors. I was looking for the statute and I can't find it. Maybe Jennifer can remember off the top of her head, or Denny, but there's a statute that provides for a 5% differential. And that statute is sort of the initial threshold. But notice that that statute says fair market value of the property, not the percentage of change. And so we have to keep pointing that out to taxpayers, that it's the fair market value differentials, not the percentage of change over the year between your property and some of your neighbors' properties. In fact, in one case, in a mediation, when they were trying to make that argument, I said, well, you know, this is a commercial property. What's your income rolls? And they looked at me with a blank stare. They said, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, well, I'd love to have your income rolls and your expenses. Let's go see if it meets a fair market value test, because the property is an income-producing property. It's a commercial property. You may be able to make an argument that your income approach is more persuasive than some of the comparables that the county is using to show on the valuation. So sometimes taxpayers don't get it, don't understand the statutes, don't understand what's happening. They don't even have the statutes in front of them. And so sometimes we actually have to help them along, especially in the initial hearing or in a mediation, to help them focus on what the issues are that they really actually need to present to us.
I found the statute.
What is that?
It's a 59-2-1006, subsection 5, and it says, in reviewing the county board's decision, the commission shall adjust property valuations to reflect a value equalized with the assessed value of other comparable properties. If the issue of equalization of property values is raised, and the commission determines that the property that is the subject of the appeal deviates in value plus or minus 5% from the assessed value of comparable properties.
Notice that is the value. That's not percentage change. We have to keep pointing that out to taxpayers. And you may want to do that yourself as taxpayers present that in your Board of Equalization, that the statute doesn't allow you to make a change based upon percent of change, it's differences in fair market value.
And I agree with Commissioner Cragen that it needs to be a systematic undervaluation.
Even though that's not found in the statute, that's actually what the Supreme Court has added as additional gloss to the statute. Yes, and you know what, I forgot to tell you, you need to actually state your name and what organization you represent when you're testifying for us. I'm sorry about that.
In case Krista doesn't know, that was Kathleen Howell, Cache County Assessor.
Exactly. I think everybody in the room knows it, but nobody listened to the tape. Please come up.
John Uleberry, Weber County Assessor. I'm curious as to how would the commission like us to present measures of comparability? So oftentimes we'll have folks come in and say, you know, my house is being overassessed compared to the neighbors, but When we present evidence, would you like a mathematical, not to get unbelievably nerdy, like a Euclidean distance measurement or Minkowski method, or do you want us just to say, look, here's, this is the eyeball test. It's within 100 square feet. It's similar in style. It's similar in quality. How would you like us to present that?
I think the latter is probably what we're going to want, where, you know, we want to know that, okay, these houses might all be the same floor plan in this neighborhood, but subject property has an unfinished basement. All the comparables have, well, let's see, it's got to go the other way. Subject property has a finished basement, and all of the comparables that are assessed at a lower value have completely unfinished basements, or subject has three fireplaces and the comparables have none, and, you know, just the kind of the same thing that you look at when you're doing an appraisal, the differences between the features in the home and the finish and so forth. My favorite is when they come in and try and tell us about how their landscaping is worse than everybody else's. Well, if you got a lawn, then you're the same as the neighbor. Doesn't matter that they have nicer shrubs.
We did have an interesting case not too long ago where the taxpayer was successful in convincing us that a particular neighborhood was actually somewhat more, less desirable than some of the comparable properties. And he had properties that were in the neighborhood that he showed as the values of those properties on sales. And they were depressed, they were down. And frankly, we were very interested why that particular little area was kind of down, and we finally decided that it was just one of those things that happened. Then we started looking at pictures of the neighborhood, and we recognized why the neighborhood looked blighted, because it was blighted. Every single home in that area, kind of water heaters in the front lawns and used cars, and, and so it was obvious that particular neighborhood was suffering from a form of economic depression that some of the comparable properties within the mile were not. So sometimes a taxpayer can make that argument, but they got to have the facts to do it.
That's a fair market value question, though, an equity question.
Yeah, that was not an equity question. That was a fair market value question. Yes, Cindy, come up.
Cindy Bullock, Iron County Assessor, and I have a follow-up to Kathleen's question with just a little different scenario. So at what point can we make adjustments to the percent complete? Oftentimes when we start, we have a set of plans and we have to make a number of assumptions as far as quality and finish and that type of thing. And then at some point during the construction process, we get out there and instead of having, vinyl floors and really inexpensive cabinets, we get out there and it's very nice and the quality is different, or we assume initially the basement is not going to be finished and then you go out there and the basement's finished. So at what point can we change that base value per se? You were saying, for your example, was 100,000 and you did the percent, but at what point can we change that base value?
Commissioner Shapiro.
I think it's come up before, and Commissioner Craig, and you might be able to help me here. Don't we have a rule that basically defines what's completed and what that tells you the percent good is?
We do, but that's not quite the question that Cindy's asking. What Cindy's asking is, okay, if we start out thinking that based on the building permits and the plans that this is going to be a $90,000 home, but as we go in each period and examine the construction of the home, we see that they're actually building a $120,000 home, at what point can we say that the base changes from $90,000 to $120,000? And I don't know. It depends on how you would be able to prove it. Certainly once the home is done, then I think you could go in and say, sure, this is what the building permit said, but this is what was actually built, and so now this is the fair market value because you've got comparable sales that you can compare it to, not just a cost estimate or value that you had with the building permit.
My experience with building permits is that they're oftentimes fairly general and generic. They show the floor plans, they show where utilities are going to be located and that sort of thing. They show potential finishes, but the finishes often differ from what the building permit that was drawn. That's just my own experience.
And that's the case. I just wondered, in an equity appeal, had that been the case in Kathleen's
I think that would have been harder, because if she was changing the base every year but was only reappraising the rest of the cabins every 5 years, I could see that might be a winning argument, that she's singling him out for reassessment every year, not just changing the percentage complete. Danny, you got anything to add on this subject? Okay.
Next question then, Danny. Let's come forward.
Danny Lytle from Property Tax Division. My question relates to, every commission has had a different complexion and how they like to deal with policy issues. We've had commissions that assumed every one of their decisions to be precedents for us, and that we should apply that to everybody. Other commissions have said that every decision is just for that market value for that particular property for that year. I assume that this commission is in that camp, and that if policy issues come up, you'll generally try to deal with those in rulemaking. Is that true? I kind of like your general impression, and I think it's important for them to understand what you believe decisions to be.
This one is kind of a work in process for me personally as the chair, and I'd like each of the commissioners to give their own opinion on this one. For me, when I first came to the commission, I sort of expected that the prior decisions would have the effect of stare decisis, because that's what I was normally used to as an attorney. For those of you who don't know, I practiced as an attorney for nearly 40 years and practiced tax. Practiced tax with the tax commission, practiced tax with the IRS. Most of my cases, frankly, were with the IRS. But as I started reviewing the Administrative Procedures Act and started reviewing the case law dealing with administrative agencies in Utah, I recognized that the strict stare decisis was not really something that administrative law really focuses on. Stare decisis, for those who don't understand the legal kind of jargon, it means that it's binding upon the next case, that the decision you made in the prior case is binding upon the next case. However, it's my feeling that our prior decisions give us guidance as to how we should be thinking about a particular issue. And if we decide that we have a different way we want to approach it, that we are then would give new guidance in that decision. The cases have a tendency to be very, very fact dependent, so that the facts of one case are significantly different than the facts of another case, even though they may be applying the same law. And so sometimes we'll be trying to apply the law the way that it was written in its strict construction against a fact pattern that's significantly different than the one that we have a redacted version on, the opinion on the log that you can review. We do feel like that if we are making major policy changes, we do need to do that by rule, and so that everyone knows that this is a new policy, that we're going to approach it a different way. We also are very cognizant of the legislature's role in actually establishing policy, that we're trying to interpret the rules that they've promulgated in the form of statutes. And the legislature is pretty defensive about that, making certain that we're not establishing policy. In fact, we've been called to task recently on supposed changes of policy, which, as we've gone and investigated, we found there hadn't been a change of policy, and there'd been some practices that were a little loose, but the policy had always been the same all the way throughout. But that's what happens when you're looking at the differences between the executive branch and the legislative branch. They're very, very jealous of that defense of that role they have to make policy. That's a little bit of a rambling answer, but that's at least what my best thinking is at this point in time. And I'd like to go through each one of the commissioners and kind of hear what they have to say. Commissioner Craig.
Okay. I think that if we're going to make policy changes, it's going to happen in the rural context. It's just as I'm thinking about orders that we've written, you know, we'll often say this argument doesn't win, as opposed to we are not going to allow that to happen, so stop making the argument. We're saying in this case you have not convinced us, so it's okay to keep trying. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, Commissioner Rockwell started with us July 1st, and I can think of three or four times where we've been in deliberations and we've said, okay, because of the way that this question is being framed, this is our answer for the order, and now we need to go into rulemaking to address the bigger policy issue because we can see it's a question that needs to be answered. So with this particular commission, and I think we did it to some extent before over the years as I've been here, but I can think of three specific occasions where we've said, okay, now we have to go change the rules because this is an issue that the rule is either they're misunderstanding what we want them to do with, under the rule, or we haven't answered the question in the rule, and so we need to go do it.
We're at a significant advantage in having Commissioner Rockwell on the commission at this time. We've specifically assigned her as to part of her portfolio, the rulemaking process. She wrote the statutes the last 22 years, many of which I carried as a senator, but she wrote them all. And so it's really very, very comforting to have her here within the commission, because as she does the rulemaking process, she knows that jealous guarding that I spoke of by the legislature of the policy decisions. Commissioner Perrell, next.
Just to follow up with what Commissioners Valentine and Craig are saying. When we deliberate these cases, then we're all together. It may seem like they're some of them are the same, but they're really not the same. And a lot of times, it gets down to applying a rule. And when we do that, there are times, just like Commissioner Cragen said, we find out that that rule isn't really doing what we thought it should do, or maybe it did that a long time ago and things have changed, and we look at changing that rule.
Commissioner Rock.
Thank you. As a commission, we do look at prior decisions and prior case law, and we strive for consistency in our rulings to provide certainty for taxpayers and for counties and for the divisions who are trying to implement the statutes and rules. That being said, I think that Commissioner Valentine is correct that a lot of these cases are very nuanced and the factual circumstances are very significant in deciding the outcome of a case, and there are times when it may appear that our decision is inconsistent with prior decisions but is based on a very nuanced factual circumstance. That being said, we are always looking for patterns of ambiguity, and when we find a pattern in a line of cases where taxpayers seem to be confused, or counties or division seems to be confused in the arguments that are being made, where we're not getting the evidence that we need to make a proper decision because there's ambiguity in the law or in statute, we do engage in rulemaking and have been, I think, more prolific in that. In recent months. Also, if we find areas where we feel like the ambiguity falls outside the scope of the statute, then we will go to the legislature, and have had several circumstances this year where we have asked for statutory changes because we want to stay within our proper role of administering and supervising and not making tax policy.
Thank you. May I piggyback on something that Councilor Rockwell just said? One of the things that we've done with the property tax division on the centrally assessed cases is we've started spending a lot more time with Paul and his team once a case is no longer under our jurisdiction, so that we can explain to them why we decided what we did and how we based our decision. And it has been very helpful. I've noticed, particularly this fall with some of the centrally assessed cases that we've been hearing, that the division's presentations are significantly better than they have been. Because of those discussions, they're now making sure that they provide us the information that they want us to be considering, and they're providing it to us in a way that helps us to understand their positions. Before, they would present information that they thought was adequate, and then we would say, we're not convinced by this information, I guess we're going to have to go with this information because it's slightly more convincing. But now, because of the way that they're presenting things, it's making it easier for us to rule the way that they want us to rule. Okay, so that's an important thing. We try to give hints in our orders. If there's something that's not there, we give hints that this is what we'd really like to see. But then also in our discussions that we have with you after cases are over, that may be helpful too. Now, I think that that's probably more applicable to the property tax division than it is to the counties, because by and large, the counties tend to win the cases because the property owners come in and they're the ones that are giving us nothing. You know, they want us to make a ruling, and so we're giving them hints in our orders. Well, like Roberts, well, if you'd given us this, or when you come to the formal hearing, and I think we gave Cindy some hints on this with one of her cases this summer, if you come to the formal hearing with this kind of information, then it will be easier for us to rule in your favor. If the hints are too subtle and we're all done with the case and you're still wondering what could you have done differently, then let's sit down and talk about it, and we can do the same thing that with you all that we've done with Paul. Any comment on that, Paul, or anything you want to?
The first time we did this.
Paul, why don't you come up to the microphone?
State your name too, Paul.
Paul Bredhauer, Property Tax Division. So the first case I can remember, I can't mention the name, but we went with you after the hearing, and you and Commissioner Perro came down and talked with us about the case, and we asked you specifically, does this apply for this case only or going forward, and you said for that case only, and we were able to resolve the rest of the years outstanding because of that understanding we had. And I think that's the main thing that we've tried to do is we've worked really hard to, with our attorneys, to be able to make better presentations. We presented a case a couple of years ago, and we thought we had a good case, and we thought we presented it well. The taxpayer's attorney had brought in something that we didn't think was an issue, and then we ended up losing it because we didn't plan on defending that issue. And so we have learned by sad experience that we have to be prepared for everything and present everything or we're going to lose. And so that's the biggest change that I think we've tried to do. And I would also say that one of the things we've done is we've tried to get more than just one person doing it all. We've tried to get the whole, if it's a utility case, we at least get almost every utility person or natural resources. And sometimes we go back, we bring people in from either side to help with the case because somebody might have a little different understanding or view of it, and it's helped us making our presentation.
Thank you. I don't know if this would apply to the counties, but I do know that Paul and his team are actually doing mock hearings in preparation for the hearings so that their staff who are going to be testifying have a chance to sit on the witness stand and be asked questions and get cross-examination and get an oddball question from the bench and those kinds of things, just so that they've been through it once before they do it. Now, most of his hearings are week-long, all-day hearings, and so it's not like yours, but maybe it's worth it to have an appraiser or an assessor have a mock hearing or a mock meeting prior to the first time they have to sit in front of a commissioner or an ALJ. Go ahead, Paul.
Come back.
That's right.
I think that that's been very important for us, and so I would recommend if the counties are going to have a one at the tax commission, especially where they're going to be using all of the new equipment that's there, because we're still trying to figure out how it all works. And I think that would be very helpful for them if they're going to go in. Usually on Fridays, there's not a lot of demand for that equipment, and you can go down on a Friday and just test out and see how it works. And that's a big step. We found out that the laser pointer doesn't work. You put it in the TV screen they have there, and it just is absorbed, and you can't do anything. So that was something that we didn't realize, and we're glad we found out about that before we got into our hearing.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Barry Conover, Executive Director. You know, Denny, next year as we have a breakout session, it may be a very important thing to do is to put on a couple of mock hearings for everybody to participate in. I think that would be very, very beneficial in our assessor school.
Kathleen again.
Okay.
That'd be great.
Oh, that's a very good point.
I think Paul raises a good point about how the division has started providing more rather than less evidence in these cases. I'm going back to this equity issue and a property that may have been upgraded, the features of the property upgraded during the course of the construction. And of course, we can't answer the question of is it permissible to make that argument mid-construction, or is it better to argue it once the construction is complete? But in the event that you do try to make that argument that the value should be increased from the percent good mid-construction, I think it would be important to present the permits showing what was originally planned, to bring photos of what has been upgraded, and to in those cases and other cases where it's a gray area and you see that it's a gray area of the law, to present more evidence rather than less supporting your position.
Commissioner Perro.
Kathleen, last year when we did that mock hearing, it was a large one, like you'd see in a centrally assessed case. Would you like to see mock hearings on a smaller scale, one that would involve your appraisers?
Okay, that'd help us. I can tell you I've seen a real upgrading of the nature of the presentations that have occurred just in my short time on the commission. For those of you who remember, I came in September of 2014. I've seen an upgrade of both the taxpayer side and the division and the county side. A couple of the cases we've had recently were just first class. They were very, very well done. We have the smart board that will take computer inputs, and people are giving us outlines of how testimony is going to be presented, outlines of closing arguments, outlines of opening arguments. They're having the exhibits that we're going to have to consider instead of having five volumes stacked on our desk and we're having to sort through them. The five volumes are still presented, the hard copies are still presented, but then the actual exhibits that are being reviewed as they're relevant to a particular case are showing up on the screen, so we can look at those and then determine what we're supposed to be looking at rather than trying to flip through volumes and volumes of exhibits. Little things like that have really helped. So those are the kinds of things we can share with you if we have a mock or if we have a more extensive training on how to make a presentation. Barry.
Yes, I want to share an experience that I had a number of years ago with the commission. We ran a commission what we back then, before the we understood the open meeting rules, we were able to meet with the commission as an administrative side. And we had a sales tax audit that came in, it came through the commission. And so we had our management of the audit division come in, and they wanted to have an explanation as to why that case was not, you know, cited on their side of the audit. We get into it, and this is where I say it's got to be equitable and fair to the commission. Our division made a determination before the hearing that they might take it so far because they felt that if they took it that far, they were definitely going to win. They had made the decision that if I take it this far, it will win. They didn't realize that the taxpayer took it a little bit further. And now all of a sudden, the ruling came down in favor of the taxpayer. The division comes in and said, well, we had evidence that we should have shared with you and to show you that that was not right. Well, that put the, you know, the commissioners were not dealing with the full deck coming from the division. I tell you, the audit division learned a valuable lesson that day, and that is you present your whole case. You present all of your information, all of your evidence, and you don't let the commission be short shift on information and evidence. And I think I compliment the property tax division and you folks as well. They have done a great job in preparing their people to testify before the commission and do it in a way that they present the whole case. That allows the commissioners to render a proper and full and complete decision. Don't just think you're going to take it to the point where you can win. It doesn't work out that way.
You notice that in our written decisions, as you get them back, that we're expanding our explanations of why we're making the decisions. We have a template that we follow that starts off with the relevant statutes, relevant rules that we're trying to employ, And then we go on through a fairly detailed discussion of the facts as it was actually presented to the commission. We can only make the decision on the facts that were actually presented to us. And as we go through that analysis, sometimes we'll find some of the witnesses are not very credible. Sometimes we'll say that the particular argument's not very believable and not doesn't seem to have much weight. And that's because that's the way it was presented to us in the actual hearing. We have to be triers of fact as well as trying to apply the law and rules that have been applied to those facts. So we try to make longer explanations than sometimes has been done in the past, and you'll see that in some of the decisions that you're receiving from us.
Just by a quick show of hands, how many of you have accessed cases off the commission's database containing redacted cases?
Good.
That's wonderful. For those of you who have not, on the Tax Commission's website, we do have a large number of redacted cases that, you know, certainly as Commissioner Valentine mentioned, the expanded discussions that we have in our cases are designed to provide guidance and instruction and to help in those areas where we feel like more evidence was needed. And I would urge you to access those redacted cases and read them. Whenever you have an issue that goes before the commission, it will provide you with guidance on those areas that we feel were inadequately presented.
Commissioner Rockwell, this is something that our auditing division does. They will print out or at least draw the attention of a taxpayer to a redacted order to say, see, this taxpayer made the same kind of argument that you're making, and this is how the commission ruled. So it may be also a tool for you to help resolve issues before they even get to a hearing before us, because you can help the taxpayer understand better how the commission sees the argument they're making.
And it is a searchable database, so you can find cases that are, you know, specific to the facts of what you're dealing with.
Equity? I think there was a question in the back. Come forward.
Pat Manus, Millard County Assessor. Now, saying the fact that I'm from Millard County, there's somewhat of a precedent set by the former assessor for off-the-wall statements, trying to not carry that tradition and avoid Ron Smith's duct tape.
I was just thinking that you and I started at the same time, so that must mean you're a veteran, too.
You know, that's the definition of veteran has changed then. Part of my question is somewhat off the wall, and then the other I think is pertinent. As we talk behind your back in break rooms or whatever, as most people do relative to talking about those who are in charge, there's always comments, and I was hoping that some of the assessors would bring up specific cases, because I don't have one. But they say some of the cases that are brought do not follow state code, that your decisions are in stark violation of what the actual code and law says. And so I guess my question is two-part. The stupid part is, are you going to admit that that ever happens, or does it? And the second part is, you've somewhat touched on that. If we feel that you've made a decision that's really off the wall, how do we approach you and say, where the did you come up with that decision?
I'll take a first stab at that. As we find those prior cases where we've done that, you'll see us trying to maneuver into applying the law the way it's written. We oftentimes have disputes as to how a law should be interpreted, because the law may be ambiguous. It may have two possible meanings. I can only think of ones that are pending cases, so I don't dare talk about those particular types, but perhaps some of my other commissioners can remember some that are not pending cases. The safety valve that the legislature installed was for the ability to go to either the trial de novo or to the direct appeal to determine whether or not the tax commission has properly applied the law. I can think of one that we're still under consideration, but the Supreme Court has made the final decision on it, but it still has ambiguity on it, and that regards an area of severance tax. I can't really go too much further than that, because then we would be trampling on the requirement that we not discuss pending cases. ATK Thiokol is probably a similar kind of situation, where we saw it one way, we were overturned by the Supreme Court, and now have to deal with how we're going to deal with the privilege tax and how we're going to interpret the statute. Legislature may make a change there. If they make a change, then we have to look at the new change to determine what the law is and how we apply it to the facts. So you're right. Sometimes we do get it wrong. The safety valve is to go to either the trial de novo or to the Supreme Court. Interesting perspective on that one is I carried the bill that established that safety valve. When I was in the Senate, I carried the bill to establish the tax court and the alternative to use that as a method other than just going straight on appeal to the Supreme Court. Others on this one? No?
I do.
Okay, Commissioner Kerrigan.
Okay, Pat. Yes, we sometimes make mistakes. I can think of one case. It's been in the time since Commissioner Valentine got here, where we were looking at a case. Yes. And we had all the facts before us. We were deliberating the case before us, and the ALJ said, but there's this decision from a few years ago, same kind of facts, same law, and the commission said this. And as we looked at the old decision, we said, well, that's dumb. It's just wrong.
It's just wrong.
And so we said, in this case, we're going to say that case was wrong and this is the ruling. So, yes, we do sometimes get it wrong. The second part of your question is, we participate in your meetings every year. We're happy. I mean, this meeting, the meeting you have in April, the meeting you have in June, and the meeting you have in November. If you identify one of those cases, I'm always happy to come talk about them. I'm sure the other commissioners can do the same thing too. All we have to do is just make sure that we're outside of the jurisdictional limitation that prevents us from talking about a pending case. So that offer is always out there. I think Cindy is the only one who has ever just called me directly, but that's out there too. If you get one back and the deadline for appealing to a formal or appealing to the courts is passed and it's not going anywhere for that particular year, give us a call and we'll talk you through it. And we'll explain to you what we were thinking, and hopefully you can determine from that discussion how you will present it for the next year's appeal if it comes in and the taxpayer tries to do the same thing, and then you can present it a different way or help us see how we were wrong before in that presentation, and then the ruling can go your way. That work?
Other questions? Yes.
Dale Peterson, Davis County Assessor. I'm a little nervous to stand up here. I'm kind of the new guy in the group, so I hesitate to throw myself out there. But and just based on the comments just made, I have a case. This is not because it meets PATH's requirements of something we think is wrong, but maybe a desire to further understand it. But based on Commissioner Cragen's, I think, comment just now, this is one where you rendered the decision, but the time frame for appeal is not passed. So is my understanding then we can't discuss that.
Okay, no. All right.
Can we discuss in general terms? Let's not. Okay.
Probably not.
Safer not.
I have made too big a fool of myself. Thank you. I appreciate that. Maybe this is a topic we can discuss.
Save it for a future meeting.
In June or
save it for a future meeting.
So is this an initial hearing order you've got there, or is that a formal hearing?
This is a formal hearing order.
Okay, and it hasn't been 30 days since the.
It was. We received it on November 16th.
So we can't talk about that yet. But we probably could in April if nobody appeals it to the courts.
We don't anticipate doing that in the taxpayer's favor, so I don't anticipate.
Okay. But if you want to talk about it before April, just call us up and we'll talk.
All right. Thank you.
Yes.
I have another question.
Come back up.
Kathleen Howell, Cache County Assessor.
I've actually been to testimony meetings where one person spoke more than one
time. Just saying. Okay, well, that would not be me.
I know that
part. That has never happened. I'm not even sure how to phrase this question, but it's a question that keeps coming to my mind. And my guess is that the other assessors are experiencing something similar. In the last several years, I would say 5 to 6 years, we have seen an increase in commercial appeals in our county. Commercial appeals are very difficult to defend or argue because of the lack of data. It would be an assessor's dream if only we had enough sales to be able to truly defend any value. And that's partly where I have a concern. Because of the lack of data, I'm not certain we're able to do an ample job of defending anything. It appears to me over the last several years, most commercial properties, at least in my county, are appealed by tax reps.
Yep.
The data that is presented are all dark buildings, meaning they're vacant. In my county, we don't have such a thing. You couldn't drive through my county and find 3 dark buildings. So it's not typical of my market. but I can't prove anything. I have no data to give you aside from putting you in the car and taking you for a ride to show you anything different. If I had a property that was dark and a property that was not dark and they both sold and I can make some comparison between what a dark building sells for and one that's not dark, I could come up with something. I don't have that kind of data. So when a tax rep comes in and he presents evidence, the evidence is never from my own county. He has to go to the Wasatch Front. So he's leaving Cache County, going to Salt Lake, pick your county, I don't care where it is. I don't even know how to, and in all fairness to the taxpayer or the tax rep, they struggle as well. I'm not faulting them for coming up with the data they do. They're having to get what they can find as well. But I'm just not sure how, in fairness to the taxpayers and the other property owners in Cache County, how I can defend a value. We could use a big business, Pepperidge Farm. If all of a sudden they hired someone out of Chicago, this happened in 93 to me, to come in and do an appraisal and everything they had was a dark building. Pepperidge Farm's been operating since 73 and it's never been dark. Not certain how valid that data is or how I should defend it and what's the best evidence to present to you folks. Don't know how to do it.
Commissioner Perkins?
Okay. All right. Okay, remember once the appeal comes to the State Tax Commission that the valuation set by the Board of Equalization has the statutory presumption of correctness. So all you have to do is get before the commission, the tax commission, the basis for the county board of equalization making its decision. So if you have a cost approach to value and that's how you determine the value and the board of equalization sustain that, bring that in and establish the foundation for why the board of equalization made the decision that it did. Okay, once you've done that, now you've got the statutory presumption in place. And you don't have to prove anything at that point. Now the burden of proof goes to the tax rep or the taxpayer, and they've got to come in and by a preponderance of the evidence, they've got to prove two things. One, that there's an error in the value set by the Board of Equalization, and two, what the better value is or what the right value is for the property. So they have to meet those two burdens. And so what you do at that point is you point out to us how they have not met that burden. And the things that you're talking about, like all of the properties they've given you are from Salt Lake County, not from Cache County. These properties have been vacant for X number of years. This property has never been vacant since it was built. You point out all of the holes in their case to show us how, yes, they may be providing you relevant evidence, but it's not sufficient evidence to meet those two hurdles to get over the statutory burden or the statutory presumption of correctness. Does that make sense?
Well said.
Yep.
Well said. Let
yep.
me just add a couple things real quickly. On the kind of example you just gave, oftentimes we'll get those presentations on those very large commercial properties on either a replacement cost or on an incomes approach. And then when we're in the incomes approach, we'll be arguing about cap rates. But the same thing still applies, that the presumption of correctness, if the Board of Equalization has a methodology that they've used, the presumption of correctness still applies, whether they use the comparable sale methodology or incomes approach or replacement cost approach. You got to show that there's an error there first. And once they overcome that, then they have to show that theirs is more persuasive. So you'll find that most of the time, the presumption of correctness stands. And even the court's now starting to vindicate us by saying, yeah, they followed the methodology of those two tests. So that you got a leg up once you've got the Board of Equalization's decision in your favor.
And I would recommend that you always get that information in so that the presumption of correctness is in place. If you want to come in and argue that the value should be higher than the Board of Equalization set, then you've got the burden of proof to establish the two things, that there's an error and there's a better value. The smart thing for you to do, though, is to get into the record the basis for the Board of Equalization's decision, and then put on your evidence why it should be higher, and the other side, and then attack the other side's evidence for why it shouldn't be lower, and then there's always the presumption in place. But if you just come in and say, we don't care what the Board of Equalization did, we just want to talk about why the value should be higher, then all we're doing is weighing the evidence between these two and ignoring the Board of Equalization value.
So because strategically or tactically,
yeah,
always try to get your BOE value into the record first so that you have a baseline upon which you could argue from. Barry and then John.
You know, sometimes it becomes an emotional issue. And emotion and common sense sometimes doesn't work well together. And I think what we've heard here today from the commission on this particular case, it is well worth doing your homework, listening to what they have said here today in this regard, and make sure that we take the emotion out. The bottom line is we want fairness and equity. That's the bottom line. That's what you want to work towards. And I think we've all been given some really good insight here from the commission on this particular issue. And I think that's one of the things our division has learned over the last few years. Sometimes I would hear after a hearing or so forth, they say, well, we lost this one and we don't really understand why we lost it or something like that. They dug into it. And they listen, and they read the decisions, and they determine where they were weak or what they should have done. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to do our homework, take the emotion out, and make sure that we're all on the same purpose, fairness and equity of those properties.
John, next. Okay, do you want to follow up?
Well, I do. Only, I love what you said. Thank you. I appreciate your comments. Let's make certain you walk us through in the training that process.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Perfect.
Exactly.
I'm glad to do that. That's good. John, next.
Would you mind giving us the statute or the rule that is more of the presumption of correctness? I look for it the other day.
Why don't you go?
Yeah,
we'll take
I'll
a second and look it up.
We'll look for it.
This issue, do either the other commissioner want to address it?
The two of you, or the three of you, brought up anything that I was going to mention.
Okay. We'll get the statutory citation for you on the presumption of correctness of the BOE here in a second. That's in the back here. I think I saw a hand. Yeah, come up. We've got about 10 more minutes, and then we'll have to close.
I think we can go as long as they want to. They have a meeting after us.
Okay.
Ken Bench, Sanford County Assessor. I would like as quickly as you can to go over with some of us again before we leave. What is the difference, and how can we expect a difference in an informal hearing as opposed to a formal hearing with a taxpayer?
Okay, let me just go through that real quickly. On the Administrative Procedures Act, they have what is called an informal hearing and a formal hearing. All of the hearings in the Tax Commission are formal hearings, okay? But in the initial hearing, okay, and I think that's what you're really talking about is the initial hearing. In the initial hearing, the presentation is done before the administrative law judge by proffers. Proffers mean that you just sort of tell your story and the taxpayer sort of tells their story, and you sort of throw the evidence and the exhibits that you want to consider in front of the AOJ, and the taxpayer does the same thing. It is less formal in that you don't have swearing in of witnesses. You don't have testimony under oath. You just have saying, if called, this is the way that would be testifying. You don't even have to necessarily have your witnesses present. You could just say this is what the witness would say. But you do run the risk that the informal will come against you if you do that. And so it's probably not a good strategic move to do that. You have to remember that if we make a decision in the initial hearing and nobody appeals, that then becomes the final agency action. And then at that point in time, you can't appeal to the court because you failed to exhaust your administrative remedies. So it's important that you recognize that initial hearing, if you choose that as an option of the three options that I spoke about at the beginning, if you choose that as an option, present your case. Don't just think because it's an initial hearing, I can just not present my case. We do disregard the initial hearing if the parties appeal and we start over again. And that's why you'll have a different administrative law judge who will actually preside at your hearing in the formal hearing than you had in the initial hearing, because we're trying to put fresh eyes on the case. But it is a much more loose process. You don't have to follow the rules of evidence. You don't have to follow the strict rules of how to proceed with a case in that initial hearing when you use that. Does that answer the question, or do you need more than that?
Did you mention that the statute actually prohibits us in an initial hearing from making a record?
That's correct. Thank you. Thank you for that reminder. Sometimes we get taxpayers who want to record the initial hearings, but the statute actually prohibits anybody from making a recording in that initial hearing. It's because that initial hearing is not the final agency action if a party appeals. Okay. Yes. Yes. You can, Cindy, you can do that in either one. Okay. In fact, you should do it in both of them. Okay. So you should start off with the initial hearing that the BOE said this.
Still working on it.
And this is what we're trying to sustain. And then if you don't like the result that you get and you go to the formal on appeal, then you should use that same methodology again. This is what the BOE said. This is what we believe is the correct value. Okay. Others on this particular issue? See, none. We're looking up your answer here quickly as fast as we can.
John, how about if we email it to you? We'll email it to you.
Okay, that sounds good. Other questions? Last call. Okay, we will then terminate the formal meeting. Thank you very much for your presentations today and for your questions today. I'll reiterate something that I said yesterday informally, now formally. Please feel free to contact us. You've heard the invitation from Commissioner Cragen once again. I'm going to reiterate the invitation I gave yesterday. If you have questions and it's not about a pending case or a case that is a reasonably imminent, please don't hesitate to contact us. We're trying to have a very open door policy in the commission to be able to talk to you as the assessors. According to the roll that I have today, 22 of the 29 county assessors were present in the room today, along with a couple of staff and five of our division staff. So thank you very much. This has been very, very helpful to have sort of eyeball to eyeball between the assessors and the commissioners.
John.
Any final comments that other members would like to make? Commissioner Rockwell.
So it appears that the presumption of correctness is rooted in case law rather than in statute. And I haven't looked at the case, but it may be rooted in the fact that the taxpayer has the burden of proof, which would imply a presumption of correctness. But the court cited, I'm looking at, the court cited a Utah Power and Light case as the authority for the presumption of correctness. And the link, go ahead.
That's what we quote in our
That's
order.
Yeah, and it says, the court says, based on this premise, the commission argues that the original valuation is entitled to a presumption of correctness. We agree that such a presumption is necessarily implied by our holding in Utah Power and Light Company. That presumption does not arise, however, unless and until available evidence supporting the original property valuation is submitted to the commission. So that goes to that issue that Kathleen raised.
So that says original, not necessarily board equalization. So my question is we can cite that case in a local board equalization hearing saying the original value has a presumption of correctness.
No.
I understand that.
No.
No.
The case that she's quoting from is a centrally assessed case, so the original valuation is the one set by the property tax division, and the first time it's appealed is at the tax commission. In your case, the original valuation set by the assessor is then appealed to the County Board of Equalization, and it's the County Board's value that is appealed to us. And so that's where the presumption lies. Now, when you're going to the Board of Equalization, your valuation is presumed correct unless the taxpayer can show otherwise.
Yep, that is correct. The case that I'm citing to is Utah Railway Company versus Tax Commission.
Yes, Cheryl.
How many times have you had this many people at a meeting?
Not since I've been there. Usually what we have is we have five or six staff people, and we make a call for presentations from the audience only because it's on the agenda. And I wait for about a five count, and then I say, okay, seeing none, we'll move on to the next item on the agenda. So good observation, Cheryl. Again, thank you so much for being here today. We'll go ahead and close the record, and then we have a quick announcement that needs to be made from Krista Johnson, our administrative assistant, regarding pending appeals.
Okay, stop it.
You want to put let's go ahead and put this on the record.
Okay.
Go ahead and put it on the record.
I'm going to be, once I receive all of the appeals from the county auditors, for those commissioners that will be going to it's more for the rural county hearings, I'll be emailing you, asking you what dates work best for you, March through May, and then also if you prefer mediations or initial hearings. So you'll be seeing an email from me.
Any questions on that? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the record. And again.